Welcome to today's Internet Seminar on ProUCL. This is Webinar Part 1, which has been sponsored by the US EPA ORD Site Characterization and Monitoring Technical Support Center. My name is Jean Downs. I'll be helping to moderate today's event, and I'm coming to you from basically EPA's Superfund program. Again, we are just a few minutes behind, but while we're still waiting for some other participants to hop on the line, we are expecting a very large audience today. I'm going to cover some basic reminders and housekeeping items for those of you who may be new to a Clean Internet Seminar. When everyone registered for today's event, you would have been directed to our seminar homepage, which had a complete description of what we're planning to cover today, including an outline, so you'll get a rough idea of how we'll spend the next 3 hours or so and which instructor will cover which portions of the presentation. On that very same seminar homepage, you're able to find a listing of our instructors. In some cases, we have bios available, but for all of them, we do have contact information, as well as for our moderator from EPA's ORD, Site Characterization Monitoring Technical Support Center, Felicia Barnett. If you haven't done so already, from that seminar homepage, you'll want to be sure to either click the button that appears on the left side to go to the seminar, so you can actually look at the slides through a web browser window, or you can follow the links that appear at the bottom of the seminar page that say download the slides for future reference. They were also emailed to you directly in an email from me. There would have been a link to say go to slides. You could open them up as either PowerPoint or PDF files. Everybody should be starting on slide number one. And in Clue-In seminars, everyone has to move through the materials based on verbal cue. So each person is responsible for advancing the slides with instructions from our presenters today. So I'd ask that everyone move ahead to slide number two. If you're looking at them hard copy, simply turn the page. If you're looking at the slides online, you'll see that there are numbered links that appear on the left side, which you can use as hyperlinks to jump to the appropriate slide. And again, I'm on slide number two. You'll also see a series of orange icons that appear along the top of the slides. The single arrow in the orange circle pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. So you can use those buttons to move back and forth. For today's audience, because it is so large, we have globally muted all phone lines. The only people who should be off of mute are our instructors. I will provide reminders, but when we get to the appropriate breaks for questions and answers, if you're on the phone lines, we'll take turns having questions come in by phone as well as through online submission forms. When we get to that Q&A period, this is a reminder to those of you who are on the phone lines, you can hit #6 to unmute your phone to ask a question. But please do not do that until we get to the official breaks for question and answer. And I'll remind you how you can do that again when we get to that point. If you are streaming the audio online, in order to submit a comment or question, you'll want to use the orange icon that has a question mark that appears on the top of your slides. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up a comment or question to us. And then again, at that appropriate break, I will read off the questions on your behalf so that our instructors can answer them. You don't have to wait until the break to type up a comment or question. You can certainly do that in advance. And in fact, we encourage that because it may take you a little bit longer than you expect to type it up. However, we won't actually read them and answer them until the designated breaks, one about midway through today's session, then we have time reserved at the end of the session. You can also use that same icon with the question mark on it to report technical difficulties. Just be sure to leave us a phone number where we can reach you so our support staff can help troubleshoot the issue. When we are all done with today's presentation, I'm going to point people to two additional links, one being a resources link where you can not only download today's presentation, but also find a link over to the ProUCL website for more information. The other link I'll point everyone to is our short feedback form, and we do ask that if you're participating today, you take a minute or two to fill that out. Another reminder is that today's session is being recorded. We had an overwhelmingly large interest in today's session. So if you weren't able to get on spots or you were unable to participate by phone today, don't worry. In about 1 to 2 weeks, we'll have a recorded version of this session available for free replay and download. All registered participants, whether you attended or did not attend, will automatically be notified by email as soon as that recording is available. So you should see an email from me again in about 2 weeks or so. And you're certainly welcome that to forward it on to your colleagues if you think that they find it interesting. I think those are the end of the official reminders I have for everyone. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3. And I'm going to turn things over to our official moderator, Felicia Barnett, who comes from the US EPA ORD Site Characterization and Monitoring Technical Support Center. Felicia?
Thank you, Jean. Good afternoon, morning to everybody. As Jean said, I'm with the Site Characterization and Monitoring Technical Support Center. And if you've done anything with ProUCL, you've probably seen my name as the contact on the webpage. I think that if we don't get to all the questions and answers today, I just want to let everybody know, please send emails to me with your questions. We'll try to respond to them as quickly as we can. And because actually the questions that we've gotten from people over the years have really helped us to keep Pro-UCL updated and so that it's relevant, you know, to as many people as possible, because we know that it's widely used. And I'm glad to see that we're getting a great deal of interest in this webinar and the one next week, and we hope they'll be useful to the customers long term. And I don't want to delay this because I know we've got a lot of material to cover. So I'm going to turn this over to our presenters, Bob Michael, and he has been responsible for a lot of the programming that is done with Pro-UCL, to be followed by Dr. Anita Singh, who works with EPA in the development and support of Pro-UCL. Bob?
Well, thank you. I assume I'm working. Can somebody confirm that?
Yes, you're there.
Can hear me?
We can hear you, Bob.
Excellent. If you will move to slide four. When we designed this, we figured that some people might want to take Pro-UCL into the fields, and we tried to keep it as simple as possible. So we set the minimum hardware requirements very, very lean. It will work on most anything, as you can see. Obviously, we hope that you're using it on a machine in your office and you have more than what you have there. As you can see, it'll work on just about anything. I've had people call me and say, do I really need that much? We've run it on even slower processors and with less memory, and it has worked. But we had to put down a minimum, so that's what we put down. If you will move to slide five. Some of my GUIs and some of the windows that come up won't fit on your screen if they're less than 800 by 600 in pixel size. So we established minimum graphics as 800 by 600, which is a standard from back in the old first Windows or the end of the DOS area. Figure we can live with that. But our preferred graphics are, if you have the old square or the old 3-to-4 ratio monitors that we had, would be the 1152 by 864 and the 1280 by 768 if you come into the widescreen era. That's where we kind of designed our thing. If you have the other, my graphics won't look quite as well. Some of my windows will wrap around because I have a menu screen that just doesn't quite fit. Stuff like that. It just, as Pro-UCL, we added stuff. It just got a little bigger, and I have too many things on the top main menu to fit an 800 by 600. It works. Nothing's wrong with it, but that's just where we're at. Moving right along to slide six, software. Anything you can put Net Framework on, and I have yet to find anything you can't put it on. I designed it on using XP operating system, but it will work on Windows 95, Windows 98. I followed all the rules for programming. I didn't make any tricks, anything that would cause problems like everybody had when they came out with Vista. It works just fine on Vista, and it works just fine on Windows 7, and it will probably work on the next flavor of Microsoft. Net Framework was the first real, well, it was a Net Framework 1, but that didn't go very far. But it, you can load Net Framework on whatever you do. Each subsequent Microsoft comes out with a newer one. It can coexist, so you can have Net 1.1, Net 2, Net 3, Net 4, whatever, on your machine at the same time. You just have to have Net 1.1 to run our current version of Pro-UCL. The last thing there is Microsoft Excel. you don't have to have Microsoft Excel. If you're a low-budget operation, maybe you can't afford a license. But it is extremely useful. We include a emulating product. It's made by a company called Farpoint, and that's what we use to get around Microsoft's licensing so which you don't actually have Excel, but it looks like Excel, but it's very limited in cutting, pasting, and moving data around. And if you have to do a whole bunch of editing, it's real nice to be able to put your file into Excel and go edit and do mess with it there. And I sure hope that most of you have Excel on your machines. I will mention this. If you have a Windows emulator on a Mac machine, people are real successful in running ProUCL on Windows emulators on Mac machines. Moving to slide 7. Anybody that hasn't already done this, it's fairly easy to do. If you have a later flavor like Vista or Windows 7, you will have a later version of .NET installed, and you will have to install .NET Framework 1.1. We are budgeting, when we package it, we include .NET Framework 1.1. That is the only part of ProUCL, it's an executable file, that installs it. But you need administrative privileges to put that on. That messes, the .NET framework messes with the registry, and so you need administrative privileges to install that. So if you have overzealous IT folks and don't have administrative privileges, you may have to involve your IT folks in installing that on your machine. Other than that, ProUCL itself is just a bunch of files, and it doesn't require any kind of special privileges to install. The other files are make a file. If you want to keep earlier flavors like ProUCL 3 or, for some reason, ProUCL 4.0, just make a new folder for ProUCL 4.1. We've upgraded 4.0 to 4.1. There's nothing in 4.0 that wasn't in 4.1 in reality. They're just missing stuff that we've added to 4.1. One thing is it was intended to run on a single machine. It is, you can't run it over a network. It needs the .NET on the machine that you're using. Moving real quickly to slide 8. Some common mistakes that when service calls come in, Felicia funnels them over to me. The two most common are people trying to run ProUCL without installing .NET 1.1 that manifests itself in several ways, and we usually get through that in about 2 emails and a oops. The other common problem is people who try to run it over a network, and again, it cannot, it has to be installed on the machine that you're doing. Moving right along, and we have some reoccurring problems that I've seen over the last 7.5, 8 years. One is overzealous IT folks. As security has got greater threat to machines, some IT folks clamp down, and they can clamp down on your machine so far that my help file won't work, even though it's a compiled HTML file. It says, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't let you run that because it could be a security risk. If that happens, I usually wind up talking to the IT folks, and there's a setting that they can do to fix it. It just stops working because they just blanketly go and turn off all privileges or tighten them all up. Microsoft sends out these updates on your machine for security. Every once in a while, these updates have stopped things of mine working because they've taken away something they shouldn't have taken away. Usually they fix it in 2 weeks, but for 2 weeks I get a ration of calls. All of a sudden, something stopped working. I've had to call Microsoft a couple times and, what the heck did you do? And I cleaned that up because I wasn't that happy. Two other problems, and then I'll get back to what Felicia says. If you have a problem, I really want to hear about it. I call them missing data blues, but you should never get different results from the same data. And we have had occasion of a couple times when my program got tricked because I never thought you would do something, the users would do something like they did, and I was treating data with only detected data as non-detected data in certain instances and then giving a different result because we have two different sets. Anyhow, if you ever get different results from what you think is the same data because you have missing values and stuff or something like that, please let me know. I will chase down what I have overlooked, and I will fix it, and I will personally send you a beta version of the version, and the very next chance I get, we will correct it. And there's just Dr. Singh and me now, and there's not that much of us to test, and we want to test it. And there's things I never thought could happen, but they happen. And if you find a problem, I want to hear about it, Anita wants to hear about it, and we want to fix it. And we try to do as much as we can with what little resources, and I hate to say it, but you people are you test for us. If you have questions, phone them through Felicia. She sends them to me, and we will fix them. And that concludes, at least I don't have it. Yeah, do I? No, I don't. So that's me. I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Bob. I believe the next speaker is Anita.
And yes. She's on slide 10.
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, good. Thank you so much. Okay, so we, with Bob's introduction about ProUCL software and hardware requirements, now we'll quickly move on to ProUCL input-output operations, data file creation and management. Slide 11. We have over the years incorporated many statistical methods in ProUCL, both for uncensored full data sets without non-detects as well as data sets with non-detect observations. And we have many graphical displays. So, we will go over methods incorporated in ProUCL to identify outliers, to perform goodness of fit tests for normal, log normal, and gamma distribution. In the last version, not the current one, I'm hoping all of you have ProUCL 4.1. If you don't have it, please try to download it from EPA website given here, because in the latest version we have fixed suggestions and errors, crashes, which occurred in earlier versions. So that's the most unbugged version, to the best of our knowledge. And ProUCL 4.1 has a couple of new modules, trend analysis and ANOVA module. So I'm using ProUCL 4.1 in today's presentation. And as I said, instead of going into the details of how the math and statistics work, you know, we will show, we will go over methods, how to use them, and where to use them and how to, you know, interpret the results generated by ProUCL. So in today's presentation, there are 6 or 5 items listed on slide 11, and that's what we will be covering. Slide 12. File operations are similar to Excel 2003. We cannot use 2007 and higher versions of Excel, but it's highly likely we will be doing that sometimes in near future. But ProUCL can read all Excel files 2003 and older. And because Excel is very common software, I'm assuming people here, they are familiar with how to use Excel files, like creating, opening, saving, cutting and pasting and all that. Next slide, please, 13. Now, you know, I'm assuming you have ProUCL on your computer. It's either on your desktop, click on it twice, or wherever. So when you click on it twice, you know, a data sheet will appear, shown on the graph, upper window there. And it's an empty worksheet. You can type in data, just like you type in Excel file. And then, in a ProUCL modules, they require headers for various columns. So the first graph on the right-hand side shows how you enter the data, and the second graph shows how you assign a label to that column, you know. So once you have entered the data, you, by right-clicking on the numbers on the top, a column window shown on the second graph on the right, header name, that will appear. And then you enter whatever header is appropriate. In this case, we are entering arsenic. And so you enter that, and then the header will be assigned. But in order for the header window to appear, you should have the data shown in the first window on the right-hand side. If you don't have data, then this header window will not appear. You know, that's one way of entering data. And as I said, ProUCL can read Excel files, so you can create your data sets beforehand instead of in ProUCL. You know, I recommend that, you know, you create your data sets beforehand and then using Excel or some other software and then read in to ProUCL. Next slide, 14. Now, ProUCL now can process data sets with non-detects. So in order to do that, we have to tell the program that this variable or this contaminant has non-detects. The example we have provided here is again for arsenic, and we are saying arsenic has some non-detects, so you have to generate a column starting with letter D, lowercase or uppercase, followed by underscore as shown here, and then the variable name, exact variable name. So if you have arsenic, then the column associated with arsenic, non-detect column, will be D underscore arsenic. And you feed in a zero value for non-detect, a one for a detected observation. So that's how you create data sets with non-detects. And in order for it to work properly without crashing, you know, we need to make sure that the arsenic column and its associated non-detect column, they have same number of observations, same number of values, as shown at the bottom there. You know, I'm showing those two arrows, one pointing to arsenic column, another one pointing to D underscore arsenic. Those two columns should have same number of values. Next slide, number 15. there are some data entry requirements. ProUCL can process and read both numerical data and text data. So here, you know, I'm just saying the text data as text column and numerical data as data column. Text columns are typically used to assign labels, groups, regions, area, dates, surface sample or subsurface sample. So those are like, you know, for information. And they can be group IDs also. And the numerical column are your values for contaminants of interest. In this case, it's polonium-210. So that's a typical pro-UCL file. You know, one column represents labels, LR-SUS. So that means, you know, those data are coming from the region LR surface samples for polonium-210. One thing, you know, ProUCL will do, if you include alphanumeric values, means mixture of characters and numerical values, in your data column, ProUCL treats them as missing values. So make sure you do not have any alphanumeric values in your data column. Next slide, 16. Here I am illustrating an example. You know, this data set came to me sometimes back, and I was confused. You know, that was the first time I was seeing. I think they were converting this from PDF file to Excel file. And then I could see many numbers, but those were read as missing by ProUCL. And the reason is in the data column, which I'm showing here by data column arrow, and the values 0.024, 0.00711, they are entered as text rather than numerical values. So, you know, as I said earlier, ProUCL in the data column, if you have a string or alphanumeric or text, it will be treated as missing. If you really have genuine missing values, then assign a very large number, such as 1 times 10 to the 31. In scientific notation, it can be entered as 1 e to the 31. If you have a value, that value in data column, ProUCL will treat as missing, and it will be ignored from all future computations. Next slide, 17. Accessing input data, saving output files. So, ProUCL has several drop-down menus. The first one is file, and it has typical file operations, you know, more or less similar to Excel. So you can open data files using the file open option. And so UCL can read in data files, Excel data file, WST, which is the worksheet, OST is the output sheet, and GST is the graphs. OST, GST, and WST files can be read only by ProUCL. And, you know, I will show you some examples of these files in next slides. In earlier versions of ProUCL, you know, we did not have Excel option in open file. Right now we have, you know, when you click on open, you will see the 4 options, XLS, WST, OST, and GST. In earlier versions, we did not have that. But we wanted to read Excel files, so in those, you know, like, version probably 3.0, 3.1, we were loading Excel data. And when used to do that, then we were able to open an Excel file using ProUCL. So that option, it was there earlier, so it's still there, but you can do that very well just using the open file option. Next slide, 18, saving data, you know, data files generated by ProUCL or output file or the graphics. So use save option under the file drop-down menu. So you save as, an output file can be saved only as an OST file, and that's the example on the first window there. So UCL can save data files, as a WST file, but those data files can also be saved as Excel files, because that's what we want. We are generating data files, creating data files using ProUCL, want them to be read by other software like Excel. So we want to save them as Excel files. So you can save them as files, and under that drop down you say other files, and then it says export Excel preserving format. So using that string of options, you can save data file and OST file in Excel format. And if you use this option, the format generated by ProUCL is preserved, and you can use that output in some Microsoft document you might be preparing. You know, I have noticed people are using that option a lot. Next slide, 19, editing data. You know, under edit option, I have three edit menu. I have three options, cut, copy, and paste. There is nothing different about these. They are very similar to Excel, copy, cut, and paste options. So, and I have shown you an example here. Now, this is the output generated by ProUCL for single sample t-test. And using, you know, you highlight the portion you want to copy, and then use the copy option and paste wherever you want to paste it in Word document. Now, if you have saved it using load Excel file option, then the format will be preserved. So if you want to use these ProUCL outputs in your Word document, I recommend to save them as other files option, and then use in your documentation. Okay, next slide, 20. Here is an example of a graph generated by ProUCL, simple box plot, and I want to save it in some Word document. So I use edit, copy graph, and then I go open some Word document and paste it there. So that way, you know, graph generated by ProUCL can be incorporated in other documents you might be working on. Or you could have just used the save as option, and then you could have saved it as a GST file for future use. But if you do that, then that GST file can be read only by ProUCL. Okay, next slide, 21. Multiple variables. You know, often in environmental studies, you know, we deal with hundreds and hundreds of contaminants. And initial versions of ProUCL, like 3.0, 3.1, could not handle multiple contaminants simultaneously. What it means, you know, if we have 10 contaminants in a data file and I want to run goodness of fit test, then I would have to run it 10 times, one for each contaminant. But in the later version, including ProUCL 4.1, we can process many contaminants simultaneously. In the example I've provided here, we have this data file with five contaminants, and let's say I want to process all of them, so I highlight them, and then I select them, and then they, you know, by clicking on those double side arrows, and then they get selected for processing of whatever module you want to deal with. And if you want to deselect them, then you highlight them in the selected GUI, you know, the three bottom variables, beryllium, and all, and so forth. You know, we deselected them by clicking on the double left arrow, and then they get deselected. So that's very useful, because we initially we had a lot of requests that they want ProUCL to process many variables simultaneously. So we can do that now. Next slide, 22. ProUCL can perform statistical analysis for several groups by choosing group by variable option. In order to use that option, you should have a group variable in your data file. And the example here, we have the first column, POPN, representing population, has three numbers, 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, and 3, 3, and so forth. So that is my group variable. I have data coming from three different groups. We have the vanadium, iron, and so forth. So we select a couple of variables here. You could have selected all of them. So the selected variables here are beryllium and vanadium, and we want to process them by group. And then you can go to various other, you know, ProUCL modules. You want to perform goodness of fit tests, then by group it will be performing goodness of fit tests individually for beryllium for three groups, for vanadium for three groups. So, you know, it can process data by group. And obviously the number of observations in the group column and the variable column should be the same. So, you know, that's what we are illustrating there by arrows. The group column there and the variables, they all have same 58 observations. Next slide, 23. You know, I mean, if there is some problem in your data, you know, ProUCL generates error messages and warning messages, and it also provides some suggestions. So suggestions are provided in blue, error and warning messages are displayed in red. Error messages are also displayed in the log panel. I will show what a log panel is. You know, it's, if you are familiar with ProUCL, you might have seen that log panel is below the ProUCL screen window. Error messages are scattered, and they require that user fix their data. You know, error messages occur when there is something wrong with your data. Warning messages are displayed to caution users about the reliability of the statistics that you have computed using your data. You know, that data might be of very small size. Technically, from mathematical point of view, you probably can compute the statistics. For example, you can compute the mean and standard deviation when you have a data set of size 2 or 3. But whether you want to use those statistics in your decision making, that's a different story. You know, so in those circumstances, ProUCL provides some warning messages. And we have some examples of these error and warning messages. Let's go to slide 24. On the left side, you know, there is an error message in the log panel there, or the warning message rather. Warning message encountered because we tried to perform some operation involving gamma distribution. Both gamma and log normal distribution can be performed only data which are greater than zero. If you have zero or negative values in your data column, you cannot use gamma distribution or log normal distribution. So that's one of the error messages there. And on the right-hand side, you know, you have a variable column arsenic with non-detect, so it has an ND column, but they don't have the same number of observations. And when we try to run here, I think we were running box plot, and because the data was not entered properly, so you ran into an error message. Next slide, 25. Warning messages are generated when statistics cannot be computed or computed statistics may not be reliable. Some of those messages are data set is too small to compute statistics, too few distinct values, negative values in data. Some examples are shown in the next slide. Here, you know, the data set had 5 observations. Actually, I did not include the whole section, you know, and it computed statistics, but it's displaying a warning message. It's not adequate to compute meaningful and reliable test statistics based upon a small data set of 5. And it also makes some suggestions. You know, your data should be at least of size 8 to 10. But anyway, if possible, you know, we should collect data based upon data quality objectives. You know, EPA has spent a lot of effort developing data quality objectives. You know, EPA, there are several EPA guidance documents describing these, and then based upon the desired data quality objectives, one can compute the number of samples needed to address the project objective. We will go over that in the next section. So, you know, there are suggestions and warnings. Next slide. It's similar. There is a warning message. You know, you have a data set, 5, all observations are the same. 111, obviously there is no statistics that can be computed based upon that data other than mean, minimum, maximum, they are all the same. So, you know, here is the error message there, I mean warning message. And we have gone over this, slide 28. Now I have negative data, negative values in my data, so some error messages are displayed right on the output sheet. Yeah, I think I'm well within time. So I think that is the last slide for input-output operations. I'm on slide 29. We'll be talking briefly about sample size determination based upon data quality objectives to address various project objectives. Slide 30. And the reason, you know, slide 30 describes the reason for that. You know, because we cannot sample the entire population. Limited time, limited resources, and it's not possible. So, you know, some sort of cleanup is going on at a site. You know, we cannot sample the entire site. We select some sampling locations, collect data, and then compute various statistics such as upper confidence limit, upper prediction limit, tolerance limit, and so forth. And because those limits are based upon sample data, we can never be 100% sure. So those statistics, they suffer from uncertainties. And we want to address those uncertainties. You know, I want to be confident that 90%, you know, I want to have some confidence in those statistics. You know, I want to be 95% confident that my mean, computed mean, is a good estimate of my population mean. If I'm performing a t-test to compare two means, I want to control my decision errors. When I'm testing hypotheses, you know, hypothesis testing will be covered in the next seminar, which is on 16th. But I cannot ignore the term hypothesis. I'll be using that a lot. So, you know, for those of you who are familiar with these very well, and for those who are not familiar with these terms, hypothesis and all that, it will be good if you can do some reading or wait for the next webinar next week. So when we are doing hypothesis testing, we can make some errors. You know, we can reject the null hypothesis when in fact it's true, or we can accept the null hypothesis when in fact it is false. Those are called decision errors. So based upon sample data, you know, I can, make decision errors. So we specify, we desired values of the decision errors and the confidence we want in our statistics. So those are part of the data quality, EPS data quality objectives. So you specify those in DQO, in your DQO process, and then based upon those specified values of your DQOs, you compute the sample size. Next slide, 31. I might have talked about some of this already. DQOs are designed to manage uncertainties and control decision errors. DQOs-based sampling strategies can be used to collect adequate amount of representative data to address uncertainties and control decision errors. In earlier versions of ProUCL, we didn't have these DQO-based sample sizes. We did have them in the last version, 4.00.05, and of course we have in this current version. And here are some of the sampling strategies we have in ProUCL for sample size. Let's go to the next slide, which is 32. So ProUCL can compute your sample sizes for estimating the mean, for verification of the attainment of cleanup standard, test for proportion of concentration, exceeding some action level or MCL, performing site versus background comparisons, upgradient versus downgradient wells, acceptance sampling to accept or reject a lot. For example, you want to determine the number of drums that should be sampled from a batch of drums consisting of 3% of drums with elevated levels of hazardous waste. Next slide. Now I'm giving you the minimum definition of these things, just for information. And in this webinar, since we are just showing you how to use ProUCL, we do not have enough time to explain them in detail, but there is some minimum definitions. You know, like type 1 error has several names: false positive, level of significance, probability, reject a null hypothesis when in fact it's true, declare a clean area dirty. It's denoted by alpha. It's also called false rejection rate. Similarly, type 2 error is the probability of not rejecting the null hypothesis when in fact it is false. Yes. There is a typo here. It's not 1 minus beta, it's beta. I'm sorry, I just noticed that. Type 2 error, that should be beta. So please correct that in your slides or I will send that, you know. This 1 minus beta is power, which we are not talking about. The type 2 error is denoted by beta and it's called false acceptance rate. Next slide, 34. Width of the gray region is determined by alternative values of the parameters of interest, mean, proportion. In gray region, consequences of committing errors, those decision errors, type 1 and type 2 errors, are likely to be not very significant. So, you know, In DKOs, you also specify the width of the gray region, how much leeway you have to commit those errors, you know, where the consequences are not that high. So gray region, the width of the gray region is also part of your DKO. You have to specify that in your DKOs. So here is an example. Null hypothesis mean is less than 100. Alternative is mean greater than 100. And width of the gray region is 20. What does it mean? This implies that the mean greater than 120, that's the alternative hypothesis in that region, is considered significantly higher than the baseline mean of 100. Next slide. This graph on the right hand side, I have taken it from EPA guidance document 2006 that came out. And it's very nice graph, explains everything. You know, in example we are talking, you know, 100 is the action level, the baseline condition. Width of the gray region is 20. So when the mean starts becoming greater than 120, then you start worrying about a false acceptance rate. When the mean is less than 100 and you are rejecting the null hypothesis, there's the false rejection rate. So you specify alpha, beta. That's what they have shown. Alpha is 0.05, beta is also 0.05. In here they have shown the power. And we are not going into that, but I just wanted to show, you know, where all these things are coming from. Next slide. Here is the first simple estimation. You know, the objective is to estimate the site mean. And before we can do that, the question is, how many samples should we collect so that our mean estimate is within 5 units with confidence coefficient of 0.95. So those are our data quality objectives. The confidence coefficient is 0.95. Allowable margin of error is 5. And that will be our width of the gray region. And so, you know, okay, estimation of mean also requires an estimate of standard deviation. That comes from similar study or some historical data, some pilot study. If you do not have a good estimate of standard deviation, you can compute these sample sizes for various values of 10 and then compare the sample sizes with your budget and then try. And once you get the data, you can probably do some power analysis in retrospect. But somehow you have to have this estimate of standard deviation, which is typically obtained from historical studies or pilot study. So in this, you know, for these specified data quality objectives, we will require minimum of 18 samples to estimate the population mean. Next slide. Verify the attainment of cleanup level. So that's the single sample t-test, assuming normality. The null hypothesis that the site has met the cleanup standard, meaning the cleanup standard is, let's say, 50. Your testing hypothesis mean is less than or equal to 50 versus the alternative is greater than 50. And data quality objective. Now here we are testing the hypothesis, so we come across decision errors. So false rejection rate, which is alpha, is specified as 0.05. False acceptance rate, which is beta, is specified as 0.1. And this also requires some estimate of standard deviation, and we get it from some previous study or pilot study. And using these DKOs, we obtain the minimum sample size of 24. And that minimum sample size is for one-sided alternative. That mean is greater than 50. If you want to perform two-sided alternative hypothesis, mean is not equal to 50. You don't care whether it's above 50 or below 50. You just want to do two-sided hypothesis, alternative hypothesis. Then you will require 29 samples. It requires slightly more samples than one-sided alternative. Next slide. Okay, this is the proportion test. You know, all these non-parametric proportion tests, fine tests, Wilcoxon fine rank tests, you know, they are used a lot in radionuclides reference studies. They are described in detail in, of course, EPA guidance documents like 2006 and also in Martin documents, you know, that 2000 Martin documents for radionuclides. And, the GUIs for all these tests, the single sample tests are the same. We will just go over one more single sample test, proportion test. And I actually used that in one of the uranium mining studies, but, you know, I'm just making these numbers. They are not the exact numbers. You know, you want to know how many sites you need to sample at a uranium mine to make sure that the proportion of sites with elevated uranium is less than 0.3. So the null hypothesis here is proportion less than 0.3 versus the alternative greater than 0.3, and then the DCO allowable decision errors, false acceptance and false rejection rates, they're specified there, 0.2 and 0.1, and then the width of the gray region, 0.15, proportion greater than 0.45, considered significantly large. So based upon these DCOs, you come up with the minimum number of samples required will be 36 for one-sided alternative. Next slide, 39. Two-sample t-test. Now that is very commonly used. Two-sample t-test assumes normality, so these data, you know, the sample size determination here, they are assuming normality, they are for normally distributed data set. Need to determine the number of site and background samples to compare that the site mean is comparable, to evaluate that the site mean is comparable to background mean versus it's not, they are not comparable. And those false acceptance and rejection rates are specified there, each equals 0.1. Width of the gray region is 10. The difference between two means greater than 10 considered significantly large. It also requires estimate of the standard deviation, the pooled estimate. You know, you assume they have fairly similar standard deviations, and an estimate of the standard deviation is 10. Based upon these values, you conclude that the minimum number of samples required to achieve these DQOs, 0.1 false negative, 0.1 false positive, width of gray region 10, you will require a minimum of 18 samples. That's two-sided alternative. Next slide, which is slide 40. We are doing the same thing, but it's non-parametric. I do want to point out in parametric tests such as t-test, we are comparing the means. In non-parametric tests, we are comparing the median. So the hypothesis I stated there, the site median is greater than or equal to the background median. versus the alternative, right median, left median, background median, and the DQOs are specified there. And it's a non-parametric test, so it does not require normality. Non-parametric test is less powerful than the parametric test, but the parametric test requires normality. And because it's less powerful, it requires more samples. The number of samples required here for one-sided is 33 from each population. You know, here, notice we are comparing means or medians of two populations. So we have two populations involved. So the numbers produced by these programs are the numbers of samples which will be collected from each population. In order to make up for the power, you know, more samples are needed for alternative hypothesis. You know, earlier, when we were doing parametric tests, we needed 18 samples from each population for two-sided alternatives on slide 39. And on slide 40 for non-parametric, we need 43 samples from each population to compare the two medians. Next slide, 41. That's acceptance sampling. Objective is to determine how many drums need to be sampled to reject or accept a batch of drums consisting of 3% of drums with unacceptable levels of hazardous waste. So the proportion of drums, non-conforming drums, is specified. You know, it's estimated. The people involved, the project team, have some idea about them. So they, let's say 20% of the drums, they know, are non-conforming. Confidence coefficient 0.95. And how many drums they allow in their sample data to be non-conforming? For non-conforming, 5. In order to accept the lot, they will have to sample minimum of 50 drums. And in those 50 drums, if they have, you know, they should not have more than 5 drums exceeding with elevated level of hazardous waste. If they allow that the number of non-conforming drums is 0, then they have to sample 14 drums, and none of those 14 drums should be unacceptable or should be non-conforming. So, you know, this module can be used to determine the number of samples needed to accept or reject a lot. Next slide. That's the last slide of this section. Data collection also depends on budget and resource to minimize sampling and analysis costs. When budget does not allow to collect DQOs based number of samples, minimum number of 8 to 10 samples should be collected. But I'm not recommending that you do that, but in case, you know, and sometimes you just cannot collect more samples. So that's the minimum you should, you know, collect to perform statistical analysis as incorporated in ProUCL. Next slide. That's the new section, and I am right on the dot. In this, we will be talking about journal statistics and graphical capabilities of ProUCL. And this covers, you know, the menu options, summary statistics and graphs in ProUCL, you know. When you load your ProUCL, you will see, you know, the various menu options given on the top. So this section covers those two. Let's go to slide 44. Summary statistics. You know, routinely we want to, before we start looking, evaluating our data, we want to just look into it. You know, simple summary statistics. This data, PCB data, we will be using in various other examples. So I've provided you the data set for those interested can try this data set on their own for various modules. So UCL can compute raw statistics on raw data. I mean, summary statistics on raw data and summary statistics on log transform data. Next slide, 45. For this PCB data size 38, it provides all these summary statistics, minimum, maximum, mean, median, variance, pertussis, skewness, coefficient of variation, and various percentiles. You know, these percentiles give you an idea about the distribution. You know, the fifth percentile is 0.88, and the 99th percentile is 24.07. So that's the... And there's one statistic which probably you haven't seen much. It's MAD med over 0.675. It's a robust estimate of standard deviation. You know, when you have outliers in your data set, variance, standard deviation, they get inflated by outside. But this value, med / 0.065, that's the resistance to outliers. And I look at it a lot. So, and it's a robust statistic, you know. Actually, EPA, we have developed another software called SCOUT for EPA, and that deals with robust statistical methods. It also has multivariate methods. It has advanced graphical capabilities. And I use that statistic a lot in that. So it's just there, and I just wanted to point out what it's for. It's an estimate of the standardization. This is an estimate. And on the bottom, we have summary statistics for log transform data. Same statistics, you know, number of observations, coefficient of variation, various percentiles. Next slide. General summary statistics by groups. We went over this earlier. So UCL can process data by groups. So for vanadium, we had three groups. You know, I want to see what are the statistics for those three groups individually. So here are the statistics. Same summary statistics for three groups, 1, 2, and 3. Next slide, 47. These journal summary statistics can be computed for data sets with non-detex also. You know, this non-detex option, drop-down menu option under summary statistics, you can see that only when your data set has non-detex column, as I'm showing here by arrow, that arsenic in the last column has 001. If you don't have a non-detect column in your data set, you will not see this with NDs menu options. And I just want to point out this full and with NDs. Full means uncensored data without NDs, you know, as if you know, data set without NDs, you know, just to abbreviate it, we are just calling it full. And with NDs means your data set has non-detect values, below detection limit observations. And here, because we are just dealing with summary statistics without doing any pre-processing and post-processing, so we, you know, here, it's just dumping in statistics based upon detect. The title says summary statistics for raw data sets with NDs using detected data only. And so UCL can do a lot more for data sets with non-detects. That will be covered later. From today, some next week. Next slide, 48, graphical displays. I cannot live without graphical displays. You know, I mean, I cannot overemphasize the use and the need for graphical displays. Whenever possible, we try to make them formal, and I will explain what we mean that the graphical displays are formal. They help me determine data distribution, data metrics, cues, and whatnot. They also help me identify outliers. I can compare data from two or more populations. They also help me identify trends in concentration over time. And above all, they help me confirm my conclusions derived using test statistics. Next slide. 49. Okay, here are the graphs we can generate using ProUCL. And that's not the only module which can generate graphs. When we go to Goodness of Fit test, you will see some graphs, and over there we will have formal graphs. So here is the PCD data size 38 we used earlier, and using this, the graphic, it's also called box and whisker plot, and I can immediately see that two observations, they are well separated from the rest of the data. They are potential outliers. Actually, box plot is used in a crude way of identifying outliers just like that, the way, you know, we have mentioned here. The median is pointed there by the arrow. Mean is 4.49. And the mean is greater than the median. And if you look at your box there, in the middle, 50% of data belongs to that middle thick portion. And the median, you know, the box is divided in such that the upper portion is thicker than the lower portion, upper portion from the median. That tells me, and also the mean tells me that my data are positively skewed to the right. And the length of the whiskers, they also tell me the same thing. Next slide. You know, it's the same vanadium data. You know, we remember we had three groups in that data set, and we plotted vanadium by the group using the group option. I do want to point out on the left side that GUI, ProUCL GUI, it says box plot, and then it says graph by groups. If you click on the individual graph option, radio button there, then the three different box plots will be generated, one for each group. If you click on select that group graph option, then all the graphs for that particular variable will be shown on that graph, and that's what we are seeing here. And this graph immediately tells me that group 3 exhibits highest level of vanadium. You know, there is more to it. I want to explain a little more on this left side on the box plot. You see four things, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the headers. Headings are label and value. You know, you can draw horizontal lines up to four values. Those values could be your some threshold, MCL, background value, upper prediction limit. So your label could be 95% upper prediction limit, and then you enter the value there on the right-hand side. The next would be your action level, and you enter the value on the right-hand side. And once, you know, you have to check those boxes on the left, you know, one, if you just select one value, or two, maximum of four. So when you do that, and then you click on the OK option, you will see those thresholds on this box plot, and that makes, you know, box plot slightly formal. You don't have to go into looking your background threshold value, like upper tolerance limit. You might just want to plot that on a graph. So, you know, ProUCL has that capability also. Next slide, 51. Here's the box plot for data sets with non-detects. You know, this data set probably has multiple detection limits. And the horizontal line automatically is displayed at the maximum detection limit, maximum, which is the value of the maximum non-detect which you feed in your data set. So maximum non-detect here is 1.3. Next graph, next slide, page 52. Now these are real data sets, real examples we have been using, you know, for various sites. This data set is from, you know, of course you will be using your two-sample hypothesis test like t-test or Wilcoxon rank sum test. But I also always want to confirm my test results, t-test statistics, maybe telling me, yes, surface oil concentrations are higher than subsurface or water zone arsenic. And, you know, the graphical display here confirms that. So, you know, in this case, I had non-detects in my data. So I cannot use my t-test. I probably cannot use my Wilcoxon rank sum test if I have multiple detection limits. I probably will have to use Gehan test. And when we have multiple detection limits in your data set, we cannot use the parametric test such as t-test, Wilcoxon rank sum test, Gehan test. We will cover that in next week. So I have gone over most of the stuff on this slide, slide 52. And now let's move to slide 53. Normal quantile-quantile plots. They represent an informal graphical method to test for approximate normality. Linear pattern displayed by the bulk data suggests approximate normality, or log normalities if you perform QQ plot on log transform data. On QQ plot, values well separated from bulk data represent potential outliers. Obvious jumps and breaks in the QQ plot, they suggest presence of multiple populations or groups. You know, you might, in your data set, some part of the data might be coming from a clean area, some might be coming from a highly contaminated, some might be intermediately contaminated. So, you know, so a QQ plot can tell me all this, you know, what's listed on this slide 53. And the options associated with QQ plots are shown on this page also. I may want to see the regression line, or I may not want to see it. So display or do not display. And these are graphical display options, self-explanatory. Next slide, page 54. Here's the same PCB data, size 38. And a quick look at this graph immediately tells me that there are two outliers. And the data does not have, other than those two outliers, that does not have any significant jumps and breaks, so the rest of the data representing the lower portion could be considered as coming from a single population. And it's not linear because, you know, there is a curvature there that suggests child is positively skewed. And one thing notice, you know, ProUCL can label these values. And so UCL can label your data on a graph by values or by observational number. So it's telling me observation 22.22, 25.15 probably represent potential outliers. Next slide, 55. Just like side-by-side box charts, I can have multiple QQ charts, one on the top of the other, to compare concentrations of more than one group. Here's the same vanadium data. And using the group by variable option, we can generate this graph. Vanadium concentration for three graphs are shown here. Vanadium for group 1 is shown in blue, for group 2 is shown in green, and for group 3 is shown in red. And it also confirms group 3 exhibits the highest level of vanadium concentration. And in addition to that, you know, I'm just looking at it and seems like vanadium from group 3 follows a linear pattern. You know, all the observations are following that red line for vanadium 3. So it seems like vanadium data from group 3 follow approximate normal distribution just by looking at the graph. Next slide, 56. We can do same thing, QQ plot for data sets with NDs. As shown, you know, my data has ND columns, so I could see that ND option on the upper box, on the top. And now, how to plot the ND value? In this particular module and graph, multiple QQ plots with NDs, you know, I have three options, which are shown on the left box there. Either I just exclude all the non-detect values, don't display them, or display the values as non-detect, you know, which are typically reported at the detection limit, or display them at one half of the detection limit. In this one particular example, we have selected the middle option, display the non-detects as they are reported in the data file. And then display regression line, I have chosen that option. So here is the QQ plot based upon that data. This data is a size 80. You know, some information is provided on this QQ plot on the right hand side. And that pink panel, number of observations 80, number of non-detects 37, mean of this regression line, and standard deviation slope, and so forth. And notice all the non-detects here are shown in red. So this data set has non-detects which exceed the detected values. So it has multiple detection limits. Next slide. Now here I just wanted to show, you know, multiple QQ plots for data sets with non-detects, you know, just like we have for data sets without any non-detects. You know, the real data from a federal facility has surface arsenic concentration, subsurface, and non-detect shown in red, and obviously subsurface arsenic concentrations are much higher than subsurface. You know, I mean, I will probably go back and verify this using Gahan test, but this graph is telling me all that. And I have various statistics shown on the right-hand side in that pink panel. Okay. Next slide. Time series class. That's new in version 4.1. The trend test module has various things which will be covered. Only graphs are covered in this section because these are graphs. Other tests, regression, Mann-Kendall and Heil-Finn test, they will be covered next seminar, webinar. So when you click on this trend test, all these things come in time series plots. We click on that and then we see two things, data only, event data. Data only means, I have data, let's say magnesium concentrations, but the time associated with those concentrations are either missing, not provided, but I know it has been, collected over a certain period of time, and I want to know whether there is some trend in that magnesium concentration from some monitoring well. So once I hit on the data only option, the following GUI appears. In order to plot it, as a time series plot, I have to provide some initial start value. If you have that information, be as accurate as you can. If not, you can just select one. And depending on number of observations you have in your data, you can use one or increment 1, 10, or whatever. So it's just a simple data plot, looking at the data graphically to see if you have any trends. And you see on the left, on that GUI, on the left red bar, I'm showing that with arrow, it says display OLS regression line, display highest interest trend line. We will be discussing that, as I said, next week. But if you choose one of those or both, they will be displayed on the graph also. And this operation can be performed by groups. If you do that, then you have to click the group graph option there. And the user can, in all the graphical displays, the user has an option to change. The default title is there. You can type in whatever you want to title for graph. It's highlighted here in blue, but you can change it for your application. Next slide, 59. So here is the simple trend graph of those values. That's the magnesium concentration, 16 of them. Now it seems like there is some upward trend. Now if I had selected those regression and tile same test option, those lines are also shown. Those trend line, the tile line is shown in red and the regression line shown in blue. And some statistical conclusion is also displayed on that graph. So that graph, the second graph at the bottom, is completely formal. You don't need any statistical output to go with it. It gives you the OLS regression line. And I'm saying these terms. We'll be discussing these or going over these next webinar. But these being graphs, I just wanted to show you these today. Next slide. Now, that was a special case. The earlier example, I did not have event data, but most cases, they do record when the sampling was conducted quarterly, yearly, or whatever. So you have both sampling event and the value. So when you have that, you use that option. In order to use that option, you should have same number of values and same number of events. Both columns should have same number of observations. And then using these options from the GUI, display OLS, you don't have to, but I just wanted to show the all the capabilities. So these are being selected. Next slide, 61. Here, you know, over there I was just picking numbers 1, 2, 3 on the horizontal line. But here, the, you know, these are yearly data, you know, starting on the horizontal line. That's what, you know, I have taken this data from 2009 Unified Guidance Document. And it says it. And all those statistics are shown on the right pink panel there. Next slide, page 62, time series for multiple groups. And that's quite useful there. You know, often you want to compare concentrations of upgradient and downgradient wells, or some only downgradient wells over a certain period of time. So you can do that. You have manganese concentration coming from three wells. So you have to have, you know, because we are dealing with groups, so you have to have a group ID column. There should be same number of observations, sampling units for each group. And then you start the initial start value and the index. Same option, similar GUI as we talked in earlier slides. And here is the graph generated using those options. So in this case, you know, this is also real data set I worked on many years ago. Groundwater data from three monitoring wells. Monitoring well one is the upgradient, which is shown in blue at the bottom, and wells 8 and 9. 8 is shown in green, and 9 is shown in red. There, you know, a quick look at that graph tells me, you know, 8 and 9 wells are significantly higher across the board, you know, all doing all sampling units. Looking at this, you know, I have provided you the statistics, you know, the conclusions. We will do that next time. But, you know, for you, you can do that. You know, in this case, we have 3 wells. You can have 10 wells. And if you decide to use, you know, compare many concentrations of many areas, it doesn't have to be just wells. It can be 10 areas of concern. So, you know, you can have that kind of graph. Okay, that's the end of this section, and I think it's a great time. Is it?
Yes. Yes, this is, we're ready to take a break. For those who just need a rest, but if you have questions, we're going to take a few now for, I think we're about maybe 5 minutes behind, so we'll try to keep this from, getting off time very much, but we'll run till about 10 till, I think, and then we'll start back in with the next section. So, Jean, do you want to take over,
sure,
organizing questions that we got?
Absolutely. So, as you've heard, we're going to take a short break. So if you need to step away, use the restroom, go ahead. For those of you on the phone lines, if you'd like to stick around and ask a question, we're going to start with you. Now, remember, I've globally muted all of the phone lines, so I'm going to provide instructions on how you can take yourself off of mute. We ask if you take yourself off of mute, identify yourself, ask the question, and then immediately go back on to mute so you won't disrupt the call. I've also got a number of questions that have been typed up electronically, and I'll get to those in just a few minutes. If you're streaming audio, you guys can continue to type up those electronic questions, and again, we'll read them off in just a few moments. So for those of you on the phone lines, let's start in the East Coast. If you're in the East Coast time zone and you have a question by phone, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6. We ask that you identify yourself or organization and ask your question. Okay, we'll move along over to the central time zone. If you have a question in the central time zone by phone, hit #6, identify yourself, and ask the question. Okay, let's move right along the mountain time zone. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, simply take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, identify yourself, and then ask your question. All right. Let's stop with, we'll go to the Pacific time zone again. Pacific time zone here in the United States. If you have a question, hit #6, identify yourself, and ask your question.
Hi, this is Neil Hutchison at Department of Toxics.
Sure, go ahead.
It wasn't well explained. Once you enter a set of data, say for a particular analyte, you have 100 results, how do you determine whether that data set is either parametric, normally distributed, or not parametric? Do you run the regression and base it on an R-squared value? How do you determine how it's distributed?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that next.
Okay. That's fine.
Tech section, goodness of fit test, we'll be talking about those.
Okay. Thank you.
Excellent. Anyone else in the Pacific time zone with a question? Again, it's #6. Identify yourself.
Yeah, hi. This is Erin Osborne. I'm in San Francisco. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes. I was just wondering if you could talk about exporting the graphs. I know a lot of that formatting seems to be set in place. Is there a way to get them out in a neutral, like black and white, where you can format the data points the way you want them to look?
And I believe you can, once you import those graphs in your Word document, you can do that. And maybe Bob knows more about how to edit a graph. Do you know, Bob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I have a couple tricks that I do for you in other ways. One thing I do is when Anita wants some data, I use a couple free things that I've got off the net. There's a program called PrintKey that allows me to screen capture. Anything, if you need black and white, you can check the black and white option when you're doing your graphics. You know, when you're setting up, there's always a black and white option in my GUIs, and it makes the fonts a little bigger, and it makes the graphics a little more pleasing for black and white options as they are displayed on your screen. You might play with that and see if that's more to your liking and what you're looking for. And as things like PrintKey 2000, you could do a Google on that. There's a free program that I get. It will allow you to capture and save to formats like TIFF or whatever you want, that you can then save as a file that you can import into a Word document or something and resize, a GIF file or whatever you want and resize to fit into your documents, to fit on your pages. And when I've had to do it for Anita, it makes it work real well. If you want some more help, there's several tricks to getting stuff out of it that are real useful. If you need more than that, fire me off an email, and I'll see if I can help you some more.
Okay, great. Thank you. And as a reminder, you can find all the contact information for our instructors on the seminar homepage. If you're looking at the slides online, you'll see an icon with a little house that appears on the top of the slides. And if you click on that house button, it'll bring you back to the seminar homepage if you'd like to look up for contact information. I'm going to switch over to a number of electronic questions that have been submitted online. And Erin, I think we've already addressed your question about exporting graphs, about editing them to remove color and change the data points. I think that's the one you just asked out loud. So I'm going to hold tight on that one. If it isn't, please feel free to type up another message and let me know, and I'll read off whatever your actual question is. But the first question online is coming from San Francisco, California, and they ask, can ProUCL 4.1 read .xlsx files? So .xlsx files. That's a new version of PowerPoint.
No, it can't yet. However, you can, most, if you get into, either, well, most, Excel files can be resaved as 2003 shortly, or I won't say shortly, I don't know when, but that is our goal, to have a 4.1.01 or 02 or 03. That's our goal sometime this year, to have it read that. I don't know when. We're going to get there. We just aren't there yet. But right now it cannot. We're working towards it, but it's not there yet. Send me an email. If I ever get a beta version that does it, I'll let you test drive it for us.
Okay. The next question comes in from McLean, Virginia, and they're asking, are there plans to incorporate additional input and output formats, such as the input of a .csv and output of a .csv?
Yeah, I would love to do that. I hadn't thought about it, but you tell me the format you want, and it's not that hard for me to do.
Excellent. The next question is actually coming in from the EPA, from their New York office, and they're referencing slide number 35. They'd like to know what EPA document that you are referencing on that slide from 2006.
Slide 35. Oh, yeah, this is, I think, EPA document 2006. It says statistics for practitioners. It should be. Let me, I think it should be on the EPA website, for ProUCL.
Yes.
EPA website.
Anita, if we need to, we can respond back to that, since it's a written message, and get back to them on that and give them the actual link.
Yes,
after,
I will.
After the web, instead of you trying to remember off your head.
Yeah, that will be good. Thanks, Felicia.
Okay, great. The next question is referencing slide number 55. They state that agreed that group number 3 appears linear, but so does group 1, and in parentheses blue. Is there a reason that group 1 is not mentioned as appearing linear?
No, that's true. I just mentioned one. Yeah, they both are linear. They both probably are, approximate, normally distributed. And we can confirm that using Shapiro-Wilk's test or Lilliefeld's test, which we'll be talking in the next section. I just did not say that. Yeah, group 1 is also linear.
Okay, great. And the last question I have submitted electronically right now is coming in from San Jose, California, and this was in referencing slide number 22. They ask, when using the group variable option, is there a specific syntax used in the column heading so that the program recognizes the groups?
Slide 22, yeah, count. It's just the count is done by the program.
I looked at every column as a potential group column, because groups can be either alpha, numeric, they can be anything. You can have groups that have words like cat, rat, cow, dog, or they can have numbers like 1, 2, 3. So any column can be a group column. So every column goes into my group variables, whereas the numeric columns are data columns. Because of that, every column is a potential group column. So no, there is every name is collected as a group column, as a potential group column. So there is nothing escapes my group column. No. The answer to the question is no.
Okay, great. Let's see if we can squeeze in one more question on the phone lines before we turn back over to the presentation. For those of you that are streaming audio, again, you guys can continue to type up comments and questions. We have more time reserved at the end of the session to go over them.
So go ahead and keep typing them up. We will continue to queue them up until the next break. Again, if you're on the phone lines and you weren't in one of the time zones that I previously called out, so this would be our international callers, please hit #6, identify yourself, and feel free to ask a question.
My name is Jim McCarty. I work for Baseline Environmental Consulting.
Sure.
I have a question about the gray area as to what would be the justification for defining that number if it's supposed to be related to the significance. I find it hard to choose a number without some justification, I guess.
The width of the gray area is, it should be the project team decision, actually. You know, all parties involved should come to an agreement that could be your gray area. You know, for example, you know, if you go to slide 35, that's where we are talking about. We are saying the action level is 100. And the hypothesis, you know, based upon the data, we want to test these hypotheses. And the alternative is mean greater than 100. And that could be 101, 104, 120, 140. And because we are just dealing with data sets, you know, we can never be 100% sure. So you know, we want to specify that when will this mean greater than 100 starts becoming significantly greater than 100. So if you specify 20, you know, I mean, then the, you know, you are allowing that the mean can be as large as 120, and then still, you know, the consequence, you know, like not rejecting or accepting the null hypothesis is still within reach, you know, whatever you specify, whether it's 1.1 or 0.2, you know, those acceptance and rejection error rates. So, you know, as an individual, it's probably, you know, it's probably not a good idea to pick your own width of the gray region, you know. The PRPs and the decision makers and the stakeholders, they all should come to an agreement to determine the value for the width of the gray region.
Okay, great. I think with that, we'll continue on. We'll close out the official break and question period right now. If that's okay with you, Felicia?
Yes, we need to get back started, and we're on slide 64 for everybody.
Jane and Felicia, could I have about a minute?
Okay. What do you need?
Well, there's a few things that I wanted to think if people are listening. On slide 17, there is a small difference between load Excel data and just reading in Excel using the open that Anita mentioned. Load Excel data does something a little different. It's a very inefficient way of reading in Excel files compared to the other, but it will read multiple worksheets. So if you have 5 worksheets, you know, in an Excel book and you want to read all 5 of them in, if you say load Excel and put a file that has 5 worksheets, it will read in all 5 worksheets. That was one of the things that somebody complained to me who was working with multiple worksheets, and we modified that, and that's why it's still around on the file menu. On 19, if you're old school like me, Control X, Control C, and Control V work for editing. And on slide 24, one of the reasons we put in red on the messages, and we have the little log panel and all the little warnings down there, is we never want our program to crash and you've done something pretty wrong with your data because you get a red message down there. If you ever crash our program, please tell me I've done something radically wrong in my programming, and I want to know about it, how you crashed it, so that I can fix it, so that somebody else doesn't do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Like I said, let's get started back again, because we, again, always have a lot of material to cover, and we want to keep everybody on time. So we're on slide 64, and back to you, Anita.
Thanks, Felicia. So we'll continue with slide 64 and then go to 65. And in this section, we'll be covering outlier tests and goodness of fit tests. Now, those two menu items are shown there. Outliers are values that do not belong to the main dominant population. Okay. It should be the team effort. The team should determine reasons. You know, once you identify an outlier, they should determine the reasons associated with identified outliers, and they should be making decisions whether those outliers should be included in your computations, you know, statistical analysis or not. So these are some of the caveats, you know, I just wanted to point out, and I probably will do that again. And so you see, next slide, please, 66. So you see, there's two outlier tests, Dixon test and Rosner test. They are classical outlier tests, and they have their limitations. You know, they are univariate, means, you know, you can just identify outliers on one contaminant at a time. You know, as I mentioned, there is this PULS software which has more advanced outlier tests for any data set, multivariate, univariate, robust. So Dixon test is meant for small data sets, and Rosner test for sample sizes of 25 or greater. And in the background, you know, these are tests, so they must be testing some hypothesis. So in the background, we are testing the null hypothesis that there are no outliers versus the alternative. For Dixon test, you know, the alternative is the largest and the smallest values are outliers. For Rosner test, you know, it's meant for large data sets, so it can test up to 10 outliers. So again, the null hypothesis for Rosner test will be there are no outliers, and the alternative hypothesis will be there are M outliers. M is less than or equal to 10, so there is 1, 2, 3. So I have to come up with a number. I have to decide how many outliers could be in the data set, you know, to be able to use Rosner test. And then notice the graphical display importance. And we will show why. Slide 67. You know, here is the PCB data set of 16 surface samples. And I provided you the data. You can play with it. And we ran for UCL. The data set is of size 16, so I can just use Dixon test. And in the output on the left box, you see it produces the number of data points in the data. It also produces the critical value, 10% critical value, or critical value for 0.10 level of significance, various ways to say the same thing, 5% critical value, 1% critical value, and then the test value. The test value of Dixon test is 0.727. And the values, larger values of test statistic cause the rejection of the null hypothesis. So here, the test statistic, you know, as you can see on the right hand side window, 727 is greater than 507 at 0.5 level. It's also even greater than 0.595 at 1% critical level. So reject the null hypothesis of no outlier and conclude that 25.15 is an outlier. Now that's a different story. How extreme is that outlier? You know, that can be determined by graphical display. And if you go to the next slide, which is 68, you know, they are the graphical displays we have. In a box plot, quickly we see that there is an outlier, which is 25.15, and the QQ plot is telling me the same thing. 25.15 is an outlier, and it's fairly extreme. You know, the project team should determine why it is, and probably if I were on the team, I probably will say not to include that in my statistical analysis. Next slide, 69. Now, there's some problems with Dixon test. It suffers from masking. Masking means, you know, if you have more than one outlier, that it cannot identify them. You know, I added two outliers to the same PCB data set, you know, we were dealing earlier, size 16. Now, with these two, that became a size 18. And the Dixon outlier test output is shown on the left side. The critical value 10, 5, and 1% are shown there. The test statistic is 0.175. And the test statistic is smaller than all critical values, leading to the conclusion that the highest value, which is 30.23, is not an outlier. If that's not an outlier, the earlier values, 28.89 or 25.15, they cannot be outliers either. So, you know, when you have more than one outlier, Dixon test does not work well. And we cannot use Rosner test because we have the 20 less data points, only 18 data points, which are less than 25. So if you go to the next slide, the graphical displays immediately tells me, yeah, those 3 points are well separated from the rest of the data. So they probably don't belong to the rest of the data. So, you know, somebody should pay attention to it and decide what to do with these. Maybe in that data there is some small area with elevated concentrations or whatever. So the Dixon test works only when you have one outlier on each end. You know, today I'm just talking about the upper end. Okay, next slide, 71, is an example of Rosner test. We have magnet data of size 25. And now I want to use Rosner test. In order to use that, I need to specify how many outliers do I have in my data. But in practice, I do not know how many outliers. So I can use the graphical display, and then using that information, I can try to test for 2 outliers or 3 or 4 or whatever. The graphical displays, they help us determine number of outliers to test using Rosner test. Next slide, 72. So here are 2 outputs generated by outlier module of 4UCL. On the left side, we are testing for 2 outliers. And on the right side, we are testing for 4 outliers. So let's review these outputs. Rosner outlier test for manganese. You know, it displays various things. It displays mean based upon 25 data points and the standard deviation, and it identifies which is the outlier, 106, its number in the data, observation number, the test value, the critical value, at 5% level, at 1% level. So here the test value, again, just like Dixon test, large values cause the rejection of the null hypothesis, meaning when the test value is greater than the critical value, you conclude that is an outlier. So here the test value is 3.43, is greater than the critical value of 2.82. So we decide that 106.3 is an outlier. And if you go to the next observation, because remember we are testing for 2 outliers here. Now after removing observation 106, the mean drops from 20.19 to 16.6, and the test value is now 3.24, on that second row, and the critical value is 2.8, so the test value is still greater than the critical value. So you conclude that that's an outlier. So that's why on the left panel we have concluded that 106.3 and 77.2, they indeed are outliers. Now if I had used 4 outlier tests, which is on the right side, and following the same process I just described for the 2 outlier things, you know, comparing the test values with the corresponding critical values, you conclude all the test values are greater than their respective 5% critical values. So at 5% level, there are 4 outliers, shown in red, 106.3, so forth, 45.9, but the last 2 values, 53.6 and 45.9, they are not outliers at 1% significance level because the corresponding test values are smaller than their respective critical values. 2.86 is less than 3.09. 3.05 is slightly less than 3.06. So that's, you know, I have this information. Now let's see what can graphical displays tell us. Next slide, 73. So the box plot tells me, yeah, there are 3 outliers on the top. The 3 high values probably are outliers. And the QQ plot is also telling me, probably those, there are 2 higher outliers, 77 and 106, and those 2 intermediate probably are outliers. So, you know, I mean, by testing using Rosner test, we concluded, yes, there are 4 outliers, but the project team probably should get involved and decide whether 45.9 and for 53.6, they indeed, you know, these are statistical outliers. But indeed, they are outliers from practical point of view, whether they should be included in the computational process or not. So that's the team decision. So, you know, statistics is good. It tells you, you know, a lot of information about your data pattern. But once you get the results back, you know, everybody has to get involved, the project team, you know, the decision makers, the PRPs, and the chemists, the risk assessors. So these are team efforts. Next slide. 74. Now, goodness of fit test. You know, the rest of the session will be talking about goodness of fit test for normal, log normal, and gamma distribution. Those are the 3 tests available in ProUCL. And in the background, what we are doing here? We are testing the data are normally distributed versus that are not normal, or you might be testing data set is gamma distributed or data set is not gamma distributed, or log normally, you know, you can also test for that. Next slide, 75. Okay, now this is, it's not a difficult concept, but still, you know, it's not that easy to understand. And in Shapiro-Will test and various other tests, we'll be talking about p-values. So I thought I will include this slide. The p-value, in older days, you know, we did not have p-values because we did not have computing power. You know, we used to see the lookup table for normal, you know, 1.96. You know, we all are familiar with the 1.28. We were comparing our t-statistic, we will see the lookup table. But today, all those critical values, in most cases, they have been replaced by p-values. So we use p-values to determine whether the hypothesis should be accepted or rejected. So here is the, you know, let's start with the first bullet there. P-values associated with the test statistic, such as Shapiro-Wilk test. Smaller the p-value, the more strongly the test statistic is going to reject your null hypothesis. P-values typically are compared with 1%, 5%, 10% levels of significance. In other words, p-value is the smallest level of significance for which you will reject the null hypothesis. P-value less than 0.05, smaller than 0.05, meaning you will reject the null hypothesis at 0.05 level significance. And I think this will become more clear, or will be clearer after you see some examples. Next slide, 676. Here are some of the goodness of fit tests we have in for UCL. For normal distribution, we have Shapiro-Wilk test and Lilliefers test. I want to point out Lilliefers test is a generalization of Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. And because it's more general than KF, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, we have not included that test here. And earlier versions of for UCL, we did not have p-value for Shapiro-Wilk, so we had these confidence levels. But we had p-values, so in some cases, these confidence levels do not matter now. For gamma distribution, we have Anderson-Darling test, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, and for gamma distribution, we do not have p-values, so these confidence level or significance levels, they do matter. And here also, we can perform GOF tests by groups or individual groups, depending upon your data set. And we can also have an option to display the regression line or not display the regression line. So the QQ plus we talked earlier, you know, data set, you know, showing linear display follows approximate normality. So we also have, in addition to these formal GOF tests, we also generate a QQ plot. And all the information, all these statistics are shown on that QQ plot. Probably it's the next slide. So let's see what we have on slide 77. Yeah, here it is. So, you know, we have a real data set, Plonium 210. We have 75 observations. And the hypothesis we are testing here, H naught, that data are normal versus it's not normal. And, you know, the data is very well behaved, fairly linear. I do not see any jumps and breaks in the QQ plot suggesting presence of multiple groups. No observations well separated from the bulk data, so no outliers. And the p-value is 0.53, which is much greater than 0.05. So we have a large p-value, so we do not reject the null hypothesis, and we conclude that our data are normally distributed. This is just the Shapiro-Wilk test. And the next slide is for Lilliefers test. In the same data set, and same thing, we have here the critical value and the test value. Test value is less than the critical value, so we do not reject the null hypothesis and conclude that data are normally distributed. I do want to point out Shapiro-Wilk test is more powerful than Lilliefers test, and earlier versions of ProUCL have Shapiro-Wilk test only for data sets of size 50, but now we have incorporated FW tests for larger data sets, size up to 2,000. So preference will be to use FW tests to test for normality and log normality.
Anita, I'm going to interrupt you. This is a reminder. We are asking everybody to keep their phone lines on mute. I'll use the global mute command if I have to, but if you did unmute your lines to ask a question, please hit, star 6 to remute your phone or use your own mute button. And since I don't hear that person responding and I can hear the background noise, I'm going to globally mute all lines. Everyone will hear a message that the leader has muted the lines, and Anita, I'm going to have you, again, and all of the instructors,
re-unmute your lines using the #6 command once you hear that message. So wait till you hear the global mute message and then hit the *6 keys to unmute so you can continue talking. Well, it looks like I can't. That the background noise is going to come probably from one of the instructors' rooms. So I need to go ahead and continue, and we'll hope that that background noise won't be too disruptive.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. So I'm on slide 79. Very similar slide. We have same.
Anita, I'm going to have to ask you to keep going. I've tried the global mute command, and it's not muting out that particular line, so go ahead and keep going if you can.
Okay. So we are performing the Peer-Away test to see if the data follow log normal distribution. There is a small data set of size 15, and Shapiro-Wilk test was used on it. And the p-value is fairly high, 0.637, greater than 0.05, the typical critical level we use, so we do not reject and conclude the data follow log normal distribution. Now, an outlier is thrown in this data set, 25.15. And we perform log normal GOF test on that data with expanded data with outlier 25.15. And still, you know, the conclusion is do not reject the null hypothesis. P-value is fairly high, 0.258. And conclude that data log normally distributed. This is suggesting that the outlier was accommodated by log normal distribution. And we will go into that in more detail later on, later slide. Next slide, let's, you know, go over the GOF test for gamma distribution.
So the one test,
Anderson-Darling test, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test. This is the same PCB data, size 15, without the outlier. Here is the QQ plot for gamma distribution. And the various relevant statistics are shown on the pink panel. PCB data without outlier, N15, mean 3.34, and so forth. Anderson-Darling test statistics is 0.432. The associated critical value is 0.745, which is less than 0.745. So we do not reject the null hypothesis and determine that the data appear to follow gamma distribution. Next slide. Two. It's the same PCB data. We included outlier, you know, just like we did for testing for log normal distribution. Remember, both log normal and gamma distributions are for skewed data sets to model skewed data sets. So why you prefer one over the other, that's what I'm trying to show you here. I already showed you that the log normal distribution tend to accommodate outliers. And let's see what happens with the gamma distribution. Here, after we included the outlier in the data set, the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test statistic becomes 0.235, which is greater than the critical value of 0.219. So we reject the null hypothesis and conclude that the data are not gamma distributed at 5% level of significance. So gamma model did not accommodate outlier. Next slide. I will briefly go over goodness of fit test for now. Somebody asked us earlier how you determine whether data are non-parametric. So if the data are not normally distributed or log normally distributed or gamma distributed, then we say they are non-parametric. We do not have various other tests like viable and all that. So for pro UCL, if the data are not normally, log normally, or gamma distributed, we say the data distribution is not discernible, so it's non-parametric, so it's better to use non-parametric methods to address our project objectives. Now, you know, some of the goodness of fit tests we have, I'm on slide 83, goodness of fit tests on data with non-detects. In order to do that, to show all the drop-down menu options here, I should have a data column, non-detect data column. So I have various options here to perform goodness of fit tests. Number one, we can exclude all the non-detects, or we can use normal ROS method. ROS stands for regression or order statistics, or gamma ROS, or log normal ROS, or we can simply replace all the non-detects by DL over 2, half of the detection limit, and then perform our goodness of fit test. I forgot to mention this GOS statistics option at the bottom. That is also available for data sets without non-detects. What it does, it just computes all the goodness of fit test statistics which are available in ProUCL. Somebody asked us that they would like to have it. So all other options, you know, whether like it's gamma, log normal, or normal, instead of doing one at a time, that last option, GOS statistics option, will do everything. So you have to go through that output. You know, it will generate an Excel sheet instead of a graph and then determine what your data distribution is. Okay, so next slide, 84. We have arsenic data from surface soils. In this case, we have replaced all the non-detects by their respective detection limit over 2. The non-detects here are shown in red. P-value, you know, we are testing for normality using Shapiro-Wilks test. So we have a p-value which is almost zero. So we reject the null hypothesis, and it's obvious looking at the graph that, you know, it doesn't follow any linear pattern displayed by the regression line. So we reject the null hypothesis. So using this scenario, DL over 2 scenario, the data are not normally distributed. Next slide, page 85. Use log normal regression on order statistic method, meaning ROS method and log data, and then using Shapiro-Wilk test. In this case, p-value is 0.04. It's very close to 0.05. You know, it rejects the null hypothesis that are log normal at 0.05 level, but not at 0.01 level. Those red dots are extrapolated or generated using log ROS method. We do not have time to go over in details of what these LROS or gamma ROS or normal ROS methods are. But a lot of details of these methods can be found in ProUCL technical guide. And the literature is abundant on these methods. Next slide, 86. That's me, I'm done with this section. So I am little, you know, I took a little extra time. Now I'm on the last section, which starts on page 86. And here we will go over various methods to compute 95% upper confidence limit, which is typically used to estimate the exposure point concentration. So actually, the earliest version of ProUCL, which probably was ProUCL 2.0, was meant to compute various upper confidence limits of the mean. And then we expanded the background module, and then we included the hypothesis testing, and we included the non-detect modules and so forth. So let's go on slide 87. Computing UCL 95 of mean. This module can compute limits for uncensored full data set as well as for data set which is non-detect. We have several methods, parametric methods as well as non-parametric methods. And if you just want the summary of all the methods, you can pick the all option there. And when you select that, UCLs using all the methods will be printed out there. And then you should review that carefully and determine which is the best estimate of the EPC term. Next slide, 88. Parametric methods include Student's T, statistic-based UCL, that assumes normality, that's why it's parametric. Lenz-H UCL, it assumes log normal distribution. Gamma distribution-based UCLs, you know, it's assuming gamma distribution, so that's why it's parametric. And we have lots of non-parametric methods, modified T. It's modified because it adjusts for skewness, you know. CLT, simple central limit theorem, can be used for large data sets, but it does not adjust for skewness. So there is adjusted version of central limit theorem, which adjusts for skewness. So adjusted CLT typically is slightly higher than CLT, UCL. And then Chebyshev UCL, based upon simple mean and standard deviation. That was introduced long time back as an alternative for Lenz HUCL. Because HUCL, as you will see, often results in elevated values even higher than the maximum value in the data set. And in earlier days, because HUCL was the norm, everybody was using it and it was exceeding the maximum value, then there is some literature that suggests that the maximum value may be used as an estimate of the exposure point concentration. And the reason was this, you know, because HUCL often much higher. So in order to alleviate that problem, we included Chebyshev. You know, it's still conservative, but it's not that, you know, it's not unstable, you know. And, but later on after that, we incorporated gamma distribution. So if your data is really gamma distributed, positively skewed data, that's the UCL one should be using. And we have various resampling methods, including jackknife, standard, percentile, BCA, bootstrap T, horse bootstrap, they are all there. There is a caution I would like to say, you know, bootstrap T and horse bootstrap, they are there, but if you have outliers in your data set, sometimes they tend to result in high or elevated UCL values. So if you really have to use the non-parametric method, then, you know, if your data are not badly behaved, then use bootstrap T or BCA or even in some cases Chebyshev UCL. Next slide, page 89. So here is our real magnet data, you know, and it's from a Navy site, and concentrations varying from something like 15.8 to 4300. and the initial steps to compute a UCL are the check for outliers, check for data normally distributed, or gamma or log normal. So we tested here on slide 89 that the data are normal. It says it's not. The p-value is, you know, 0.001. So we reject the null hypothesis that are not normally distributed. Let's see what happens when we do gamma distribution test log normal. The first graph on slide 90 is the gamma GOF graph, and the second graph is for log normal GOF graph. And both are suggesting that the gamma are, the data are gamma distributed as well as log normally distributed. The Anderson-Darling test statistic is 0.239, which is smaller than the critical value, 0.782, that's why it's gamma. And for the log normal distribution, the p-value is fairly large, that's why it's log normal. Next slide, case 91. So we computed, using the all option, we computed all the statistics, all the UCLs, so UCL can compute. We know the data with, based on, data of sample size 17 follow gamma distribution as well as log normal distribution. So if you are on slide 91, you will see the 95%. There are two ways one can compute gamma UCL, is approximate and adjusted. The difference typically between the two of them is that not that significant. If there is significant difference, then, you know, I tend to use approximate gamma UCL. And in so UCL technical guide, you can find, you know, for those who are interested, find the details about these methods and the references. And if you go on the right-hand side on page 19, the HUCL is 5,182, and the gamma UCL is 1,652. The percentiles, they are not there, but you know, I checked it later on. The 80th percentile for this data set is 1,282. And the 90th percentile of this data set is 2,194. So I'm just trying to show, you know, I mean, that at UCL, it just really becomes very high, and it should not be there anymore. You know, I mean, it's in there for UCL for historical reasons. It's very seldom we recommend the use of at UCL. Next slide. Page 92, influence of outliers on UCL 95. Same magnitude data. You know, earlier I showed you the graph where the graph suggested that 3250 and 4300 probably are outliers. And the data set is of size 17, so we'll use Dixon test there. In this case, you know, it did identify 4300 as an outlier. And then using the sequential process, you know, once that's an outlier, we took that out. And then based upon data set of size 16, we identified that 3250 is also an outlier. So there are two outliers in this data set. Now what to do with these, you know, whether we should include those in the computations or not, you know, again, the team should make a decision. I have shown you in earlier slides the results based upon the data set with these two outliers. Let's see what happens when we take these outliers from the data set. Next slide, slide 93. So we have removed those two outliers and we wanted to see if data that follows the normal distribution after removing those outliers. still it does not follow normal. At 0.05 level of significance, p-value is only 0.042. The next slide has the GOF test for gamma distribution and log normal distribution. The data set passes both tests, follows gamma distribution, and it tends to follow log normal distribution without two outliers. Next slide, page 95. I'm probably on time, right?
Yes, you're fine.
Oh, yeah, you're very good.
Thank you, thank you. Various UCL values without two outliers. Based upon gamma distribution, at the bottom there, we have UCL 912.8. Based upon log normal distribution, we have HUCL still 2550, you know, which is more than, you know, it's almost twice as large as, slightly less as large as the maximum value there. After removing two outliers, the maximum value is 149. You can see that on the top of that output. This output is again generated using the all option. And so you see the difference. You know, I have a slide where I will show the comparison, but I want to go over briefly all the statistics which are listed on this slide 95 generated by ProUCL. That is students TUCL 742. That is students normality, and their adjusted CLT is 756. Modified T 747, and then various bootstrap statistics. Non-parametric, they are on the right-hand corner there. Jackknife, standard bootstrap T, false bootstrap, percentile bootstrap, BCA bootstrap, and so forth. But these are all non-parametric. In this case, our data set follows gamma distribution, so that's the one we should be using. So the one we should be using is highlighted here in blue, which is 912.8. Next slide. Okay, that's the repeat of what I had in the earlier slide. But you know, here it's important to go over some of these statistics for gamma distribution. K star, theta star. K star is the shape parameter, theta is the scale parameter, maximum likelihood estimate of mean, which is 519, and the standard deviation, and you know, various other intermediate calculations. So there is a lot involved to come to that UCL there. And then in between, you know, these output also gives you the test statistics, you know, goodness of fit test statistic again. So you see Anderson-Darling test is not rejecting the null hypothesis. The test statistic is smaller than the critical value. Similarly, Kolmogorov test statistic is less than the 5% critical value. So we are concluding that the data are gamma distributed. So I just went over, you know, what you have already seen in our slides. And here is some, you know, where are these suggestions made, you know, why I'm saying use the gamma distribution based UCL, which is 912.8. You know, we did an extensive simulation study, you know, in 2002. That's an EPA report. And based upon that study, you know, we are making these recommendations. You know, if you have some questions, additional insights, you may want to consult a statistician. Next slide. 97. Now, that's what I was talking about, the summary of various estimates of exposure point concentrations are given there. We know we had two outliers, 4300 and 3550. The first column has various methods there. The second column is the entire data set with outliers. The third column has the statistics without outliers. So, you know, the gamma UCL, the recommended gamma UCL with outliers is 1652, whereas without outliers is 912. And of course, log normal UCL, which was a common practice, in about 10 years ago. You know, people are moving away from it. You know, they are significantly high. And if we did not have gamma distribution and they were testing UCL, and then when they exceed the maximum value in earlier days, you know, they would default to the maximum value, which is 4300 with outliers and 1490 without outliers. So, you know, I mean, the project team should decide whether they should include the outliers or not. You know, the UCL, recommended UCL in this case is 1652 with outliers and 912 without outliers. So, you know, those are the best statistics one can compute based upon the data given to us. And so everybody involved should make a decision which one to use. Next slide, page 98, my steps to compute UCL using TrueUCL. You know, we have gone over this, but I will summarize it. Identify outliers, multiple populations. If justified, study them separately. Project team has to get involved and perform GOS tests. Look at your data graphically using box plots and QQ plots. Use UCL 95 as recommended by ProUCL. And gamma distribution is better suited than log normal distribution. A wide use of log normal distribution and its at UCL for various reasons, and I think I discussed those a few slides back. You may want to read it instead of me repeating it. With that, I conclude my session here. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Thanks, Anita. We're going to have a little definite time for our question and answer session now. It's also a break if anybody needs it. So, Jean,
okay.
You want to start like we did last time, go East Coast, West Coast, if there's any
yep.
questions out there?
We'll do that. Again, we're going to start with the phone lines, and then we'll switch over and I'll start reading off the electronic questions. If you are online or have the option to type them up and using that question mark button, you can certainly do that now at any point in time. There's no need to wait. You can keep submitting them. And, in fact, we highly encourage people to type the questions up electronically if you can, because we're capturing all of that information. And anything that we may not be able to answer in our time allotted today will be shared with all of the presenters so they can work to follow up and get you answers afterward. So please take a moment to type up your questions now if you haven't done so already. But while we are still here, we do have about 18 or 19 minutes left in the session, let's switch back to the phone line participants and see if anybody in the East Coast time zone has a question that they'd like to ask. Again, if you're on the phone lines and you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, you'll want to go ahead and hit #6 to take yourself off of mute. Identify yourself, ask the question, and then we ask you, go ahead and remute. You can use your own mute button or hit *6 to remute so our instructors can answer.
Hi, yes, this is Ben Blasheim with Civil Environmental Consultants. I've got a question about the format that the UCL results are displayed in, and if there's any way that there could be just a table format of this is the analyte and then this is the UCL or anything like that. just the summary of all of those results of the recommendations.
Bob, I will let you take that.
Boy, we did that in Crew UCL 3 because the state of Arizona asked us to do, and they had some money to pay us to do it. It was a fixed format output, if you looked at 3.0, so that they can incorporate it into processing large chunks of data in a timely manner. They were doing a whole bunch of gas station cleanups, and it is something that if I had the resources, I would like to add. I know what you're looking at is some way that you could, I'm assuming, you could get data out, and so we even added a column requires human intervention, so that some data that if you're processing big chunks, you get, is that what you're getting at, sir?
Yes. So that...
I don't have that. It's not high, hasn't bubbled up high on the priority list, and it is sure something that you're not the first person to ask for, but resources are limited, and as you know, the funding situation, the squeakiest wheel gets the attention right now. I guess the way to talk to bubble it up is to talk to Felicia, but I don't know. I can't say that that's in the works.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, great. Again, you'll want to hit star six to remute your phone line. And let's move to the Central time zone. If you're on the phones there in Central and you'd like to ask a question, hit #6, identify yourself, and go ahead and make your comment. Okay, moving right along to the Mountain time zone. Again, hit #6 so that you can unmute and go ahead and identify yourself to ask your question. Okay, let's move back over to the Pacific time zone. If you have a question in the Pacific time zone, go ahead and hit #6 to unmute and identify yourself and ask your question. All right, and let's just double check and see if any of our international callers or anyone not in one of the time zones that I previously called out, if you're on the phone lines, if you have a question, hit #6 and identify yourself.
Hi, this is Randy Sherman. I work with Shaw Environmental.
Sure, go ahead.
One of the things I would recommend or comment on, it was helpful for me to fill out the spreadsheet as we went along for future. If you could create a spreadsheet or a worksheet that can be used for the various slides to review using the program, I think it would be very helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, anyone from another time zone? Okay, I've got a number of electronic questions that have been submitted, so I'm going to start reading some of those off. And I'm going to start with one coming in from Lander, Wyoming, pardon me. This comes in from the state environmental agency there. They state, we are not sure if this question has already been asked, but are the data sets being used in the presentation available for download? And this is related to that comment that was just made. It would be very helpful to have the data sets available so that people can follow along. And if not yet, they suggest that to be made available for the seminar on the 16th.
Yeah, we can certainly do that. And how will it work?
Well, I can think of a few ways what you could, it all depends on how you set up your slides. What some groups have done in the past is if you have a sample data set available, you could post that on the ProUCL website and then provide screenshots so that you can literally walk people through the example of loading the data sets into ProUCL and then the actual exercises of what they do to arrive at the graphs or outputs that you're showing. But that's something we can talk about offline, Anita, with Felicia.
Okay.
The next question is coming in from the North Carolina Division of Public Health in Raleigh, North Carolina. They ask, was there a text error identified on slide number 33?
Slide number 33. Okay.
Yeah, that was 1 minus beta is beta.
Yeah, that's what I think I mentioned that, you know, that 1 minus beta is the power, that value should be beta. Thanks for, I reviewed that slide. I didn't notice it, and I just noticed when I was talking about it. Yeah, that's an error. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in St. Paul, and they ask, when examining data sets for outliers, I usually run a regression plot of the data in sigma plot and then look for data points outside the 95% prediction intervals. How does this method compare to the methods one can use in ProUCL?
You can use that method. You know, in order to use regression, you probably are dealing with the two-dimensional data. And when we were talking about it, you know, I mentioned the methods we have, you know, Rosner test and Dixon test. You know, they are coming from EPA guidance documents. They are in, soil sampling, groundwater, sediment sampling, you know, in all those EPA guidance documents. And there are more advanced methods for multivariate data that includes bivariate data, where you can perform regression and then draw the prediction limit and even the confidence limit around the regression line and determine your, you know, outliers. And for, you know, I do want to mention, you know, for outliers in multidimensional, such as your case, there are other, you know, robust methods. And several of those are in Scout software, which can be downloaded from EPA guidance document. And it has some technical guide, which has a whole, you know, literature on identifying outliers in various cases. You know, if you are interested, you can go there also.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from Cypress, California. They ask, what statistic does the upper and lower whisker in the box plot represent?
Okay, the whiskers, you know, they start from the box. You know, you have the box which contains 50% of the data. So the lower whisker starts from Q1, the lower edge of the box, and then it extends Q1 minus 1.5 times the range of the data. Range is, no, it's not the range, it's Q3 minus Q1, which is the interquartile range. So Q3 is the upper edge of the box, Q1 is the lower edge of the box, and the whisker is the lower whisker starts from the lower edge, which is Q1, and extends to Q1 minus 1.5 times interquartile range, which is Q3 minus Q1. Similarly, the upper whisker starts with Q3, and then that extends to Q3 plus 1.5 times IQR. That's my answer.
Okay, great. The next question is coming in from SAIC in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, perhaps is more of a clarification. They say, remember that both Dixon's and Rosner's tests assume normality. If the data are not normally distributed, the data should be transformed into approximate normality, if you can, before you're using either Dixon's or Rosner's. On slide number 73, the QQ plot appears to be log normally distributed, so I would not determine the highest score results to be outliers.
That's vicious, you know, I wish I have a lot of time to discuss this topic. just a vicious circle, you know. This normality is destroyed by the presence of outliers, you know, and if there are outliers, the data probably are not normally distributed. You know, to correct you, you know, I think you should be saying that data without the outliers are normally distributed. You know, one should not, you know, I mean, perform outlier tests on log transform data because that accommodates outlier. I showed you, I think, in a couple of examples. And so, you know, outliers and normality, they go hand in hand. To be more precise, one should be using robust, which do not require assumptions, robust outlier tests, which we do not have in ProUCL, because ProUCL, you know, started with basic fundamentals, which are, you know, describing various EPA guidance documents. The research topics dealing with robust tests, they are, you know, there are many methods, you know, Tukey's bi-weight method, MCD method, you know, and inference function-based M estimation method. Those are the ones which should be used to identify outliers, and they do not require assumption of normality. And, you know, I think, correct, you know, in some, you know, I mean, outliers in environmental applications, you know, the data set in environmental applications, they represent observations from different populations. So it's not fair to assume that data has to be normal, or you just take the log normal and accommodate that outlier, you know. So, you know, the data is typically normally distributed after taking the outliers out. So it's a vicious circle, you know, and I can go on and on. I have worked a lot on outlier things, you know, I mean, sometimes I call myself an outlier, you know, from that respect. Scout is the software that should be used to really identify outliers, whether they are univariate or multivariate. That's the comment.
Would the SAIC people, I'd ask you to download our product Scout and play with our MCD methods and some of the things that we have coded. I can tell you to code the rudimentary stuff in Dixon and Rossner. There's not much there, and there's not much you can do with univariate outlier tests there. And the stuff that we have put in Scout will find you outliers, and it will find it right. And I'd ask you to download that and play with that, and maybe you will find an outlier when it really is an outlier.
Okay. The next question is also coming in from Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And they ask, on the QQ plots, can ProUCL display the y-axis on a log 10 scale for a log normal probability plot?
Yeah, just dealing with the natural logarithm. Log 10 scale, probably not. You know, we do not have a transformation in ProUCL, Bob. We have those in Scout, right?
Right,
We can, you know, one can transform it outside ProUCL and then do a QQ plot on normal QQ plot on transform data. Now, you know, on log to the 10 scale, we cannot do that in ProUCL as it stands today.
Not in that, dang, it would be trivial for me to add it, but again, nobody's ever asked for that before.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next question. This is actually an international question coming in from a consulting firm in Lisbon, Portugal. They state ProUCL still computes and outputs H statistic based on UCLs for, quote, historical reasons. The use of non-paired metric methods are preferred to compute UCL95 for skewed data sets which do not follow a gamma distribution. Apart from this reason, have you identified any practical reason for keeping the, quote, H statistic results on the general UCL statistics for full data sets?
Probably not. You know, we We consulted other, people here, in Las Vegas EPA, and for historical reasons, we wanted to include everything. You know, if it's up to me, I will probably take, some of the methods out, HUCL, probably not HUCL, but various other, MVU, the log normal distribution based other UCLs, based upon Chebyshev using MVUE, minimum variance unbiased estimator methods. To answer their questions, these are, some of the UCLs are there for historical reasons. And I know that complicates the output. They don't have to include in their final report. And we know some of the users, consultants, they have ways, they have developed their Excel programs which extract information, relevant information to their application, and then they include that in document. So it probably should be an easy exercise to write your own Excel program and then extract needed information from pro UCL outputs. What we have, pro UCL is a mixture of practical applications described in various EPA applications, documents, and some of it is based upon our research. So it has become kind of huge, and we never took some of the things out. They are there. Okay.
I share your pain. It makes my program messy in certain aspects, and I try to keep it clean. But there are people that want it and say, I need it just to show why I don't use it.
Okay. I'm going to squeeze in one more question online because we are rapidly approaching our 4 p.m. Close time here. So let's take this one last question that's come in from Oakland, California. And please note, we do have all of the other electronic questions, and I will share those with the speakers and our presenters today so that they can answer you offline. So don't worry, your questions won't get lost. And if you haven't asked one, go ahead and type it up right now. I'll provide information for everyone again at the close if you're on phones, how you can ask a question when we close out today. So taking the last question online, this one comes in again from a company in Oakland, California, and they state, ProUCL version 4 indicates that the software has been designed for samples that represent a single population. We are often asked to estimate mean lead concentrations for blended populations, i.e. lead-contaminated surface soil that is combined with soil containing background levels of lead. Could ProUCL be used to accommodate these blended data sets? Anita, if you're on the phone lines, you may have muted yourself accidentally. You want to be sure to hit #6 just in case. Perhaps any of the other presenters that are on the phone, could you provide an answer to that? If ProUCL can handle a blended data set?
I am a humble programmer. I do not dare venture into answering that completely, but I can tell you that statistically speaking, it is just one of a multitude of tools that we, Dr. Singh and I, have developed, Scout being the other one, which I know has much more for multivariate, and I believe the answer is that if the tools aren't there just in ProUCL, they might be in, we might have them in Scout. I don't know if ProUCL is complete enough to deal with the blending, but I'm sure that it's a heck of a good start, if not complete. And I sure wish Anita was here to, when I'm not programming, I'm assisting her in dealing with just this kind of a thing. Get this data out of this, get this out, and fix this, modify this, rewrite this. Come back, Anita.
Don't worry. I've got a copy of that question as well as the person who submitted it. So I'll be sure to share that with you guys.
Jane, I just want to mention, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
This is Nancy. Next week I will be presenting a case study on how to extract background data and expand background data. And one of the issues, you know, that we have at that particular case study, that case study will present information on how you can separate anthropogenic background, site-related and non-site-related. Some of the arsenic at this particular facility is probably due to pesticides, and so our task was to kind of separate the site-related and non-site-related backgrounds there. So that would be one way of doing it, separating the populations, maybe using background threshold values to make that separation, and plotting the data on a QT plot. And you can immediately see the inflection point where you have that separation between what background could be and what the on-site data is. And, of course, you know, the team would need to make that determination where that cutoff point would be. So, and I know that with lead sites, we do have that issue where background can be both anthropogenic and anthropogenic site-related and non-site-related. So that is a good question. Maybe Anita, if she's back, she can give us some more information on that. But I will be presenting a case study next week on that, and maybe she can handle that question again later.
Okay, great. Anita, are you back with us? Okay, don't worry. I will definitely get a copy of that question to the speaker so that she can give you a direct response.
Yeah, we'll definitely try to get to answering all of those questions that we can.
Okay.
And of course, if there's something that afterwards that you forget, wasn't answered here, that you think about it, and our emails are out there, especially mine. Like I said, I'm on the website for ProUCL. Send them to me. I don't think there's any question we've ever gotten we haven't sent a response back about.
Okay, great. Are there any other closing comments or statements that Felicia, you or the other instructors would like to make?
Just thank everybody for the interest and also for the use, and also, as I said earlier, in the comments that we get as people use it, because it has helped us try to keep it up to date and relevant as best we can, giving everybody's time and budgets and that sort of thing. But we hope that it's been helpful to everybody to have the class and for those who are going to be attending the next webinar next week.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Excellent. You're welcome. So with that, I'm going to lead everyone on to the final slide in today's presentation material, which is slide number 100. As I mentioned at the start of today's session, I'm going to point you guys to two important links. You can access these very same links from the seminar homepage. So if you do have a print copy in front of you and you can't access the computer with internet right now, you can certainly go back to them, referring to that seminar URL or homepage that you received when you signed up, as well as in the reminder emails from us. The first link I want to point out is the additional resources link. You'll find it on the seminar homepage. There are buttons that say links. Our links to resources. If you click on that, that'll not only give you the option to download today's PowerPoint presentation, but it'll also bring you back over to the ProUCL homepage, where you'll be able to download the software as well as a number of other related documents on today's topic. The second link I want to point out is a short feedback form. We do ask everyone to fill out that feedback form if you can. It only takes a few minutes to do it. I do read each and every single one of those responses, so if you thought that today's session was helpful and you'd like to continue to see free technical training like this delivered through Kluin, please fill out that feedback form and let us know what you thought. For those of you who are sharing the line with multiple participants, every time you submit feedback, there will be a link that will appear that will allow someone else to fill out their own feedback form. So if you had 10 people in the room with you, each person can sit down and fill out the form individually. And, of course, you can always go back to that homepage and get to the feedback form link if you need to do it tomorrow or another day to go ahead and submit it. If you're participating today and looking to get credits for either CEUs or PDHs, we don't offer those through Kluin, but what we will give you if you fill out feedback, you can check a box and actually have a confirmation message sent to you for your records by email. Sometimes our participants have been able to earn credit for these sessions by having a copy of their registration confirmation message, a copy of the PowerPoint materials, and a copy of that confirmation message verifying that they did submit feedback at the end of the session to prove that they did participate. As I did mention, we do have a copy of all of the questions that were typed electronically, and I will be sharing those with our instructors today. For those of you on the phone lines, though, or if you have a question that comes up or occurs to you afterwards and you'd like to get in touch with our instructors, all of their contact information are listed on the Kluwen homepage. So as we mentioned, you'll find Felicia, you'll find Anita, you'll find Mike. Everybody is listed up there along with their phone numbers and email addresses. You can also find Felicia Barnett, her contact information from the ProUCL website. You're certainly welcome to contact them, again, offline. So, again, the session was recorded. We should have a recorded version available to everybody who participated today. And we had over 450 people from all over the world that were here with us, so I appreciate everyone who was able to join in. Again, you'll get a confirmation message as soon as the recorded session is available for free replay and download. So with that, I want to, again, extend my thanks to our sponsors today from ORD here at EPA who set up today's presentation. I also want to thank our many speakers who were able to pull together the materials and present the session, as well as our numerous participants from all over the world. I hope that you found today's Kluwen Internet Seminar a useful expenditure of your time and that we'll hear from you or see you on a future one. If you are really interested in this topic, the next ProUCL webinar is scheduled to happen next week on March 16th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you do see that the session is full, if you try to sign up, you can go to the Kluwen homepage and follow the links for training. You go ahead and put your name on the wait list because we're working out extra phone lines for that session as well. So we may be able to accommodate those on the wait list. So go ahead and sign up if you're interested. So again, thank you to everyone who participated. And this will be the formal conclusion for today's Kluwen seminar. Thank you all. Have a great day.